Welcome everyone. Just in a couple of minutes, we'll give Holly a moment to get here. So I was going to say that I have slotted in on a class for next week as well. We were going to have 20 classes, then I decided 19, and now I've decided 20 again. So we've got a few more topics that we can cover next week. If you can make it, that would be excellent. Because it has been quite a long, varied meandering through all of the basic Buddhist principles. But I really enjoyed being able to present it this way a little bit more in depth than having to rush through things. So let's just take a moment to kind of set our posture and then adjust our motivation. So just like we've been talking about the posture, the quick way to adjust the posture is the two-part posture, straight spine and relaxed body. How we can do it so that it's experiential from the inside is imagine that your spine has like a thread of light running through it, running up through your, just in front of the spine, up through your body, and this thread of light comes out the crown of your head, and feel like you're being supported from your crown. And if you can really imagine that, if you're quite tired, you can feel that the weight of your body is being supported. So it's much easier to keep your posture upright and alert. It also means that your spine becomes naturally aligned. So still keeping the natural curvature. It also means that you'll notice your head should just tilt forward slightly, tuck the chin in. You might find you just lean back a little bit to become more aligned. And then once the spine is straight, then relax the shoulders. And if you feel the tension, then squish your shoulders up to your ears and let them drop. So you get a really good before and after squish, 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 and let them drop. And it's a great way of actually being able to release any tension held in the neck or the shoulders. If you can, hands in the palm, right palm on top of left with the thumbs lightly touching, just resting there in the lap. Elbows a little out from the torso. Jaw relaxed, slight smile on the lips. Tongue resting on the upper palate behind the top teeth. And eyes slightly open. So some light is still coming in so that we don't just immediately associate it with sleep. Just a little open or very lightly closed. A couple of deep breaths, letting out any stale air from the lungs. Become aware of any of the noise or chatter in the mind without getting involved. Just if it arises, just set it aside and instead bring your focus to the breath, the rising and falling of the breath. So anything else, even if every moment something else arises in the mind, just put it aside, bring your focus back to the breath. And it might be easier to focus if you say to yourself in and out as you're breathing, just simply that. And as your mind also begins to settle, become stable, all the thoughts and busyness Just coming to rest, just like autumn leaves come to rest once the wind has stopped. Then we can take a moment to reflect, why are we here? What is our purpose of being here tonight? So why are we putting in the effort to make the time and to concentrate and to come along? And we can make sure that we answer the purpose for oneself and the purpose for others. So the work or the purpose for oneself is to be able to become free of all the disturbing emotions, become free of the ups and downs of life, and free of all of the confusion and ignorance that tangles us up. To be able to release thoughts of or feelings of aversion and attachment, and to be able to develop the wisdom that understands our reality and our potential, and that can cut the causes of suffering forever. So the work for oneself is mostly focused around renunciation, or this wish to emerge from cyclic existence, supported by our wisdom. And then the work for others, the purpose for others, our whole purpose in life, to help others, to serve others, to give back for the kindness of others, and to liberate others from suffering just as we ourselves wish to be free. So does everyone else. No one wants to suffer. No one wants problems. Everyone has hopes and dreams and wishes, and yet no one knows how to go about it. And we have this incredible window of opportunity to help all living beings. So our purpose for others is bodhicitta, this altruistic attitude to develop all of our skills and qualities all the way to enlightenment so we can perfectly help others. And this too is supported and informed by our wisdom. So with this sense of the big picture of why we're here, then we can do this class, all the steps on the way to enlightenment for ourselves and all others. So take a deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. Open your eyes if they're closed. So tonight I wanted to, we'll cover a couple of things. So one of them is about how to find a guru or a spiritual teacher, or what even is a spiritual teacher? What are the characteristics to look for? How do we know if we've found a spiritual teacher? Then we're going to have a look at how to do the speech blessing, because most of how we are in the world, how we communicate with everybody, it's not so much physically, and people don't necessarily know what's going on with our mind, but pretty much how we interact with the whole rest of the world is through our speech. So how to bless our speech to make sure that our speech is beneficial. Right at the end, we'll have a little kind of regroup of then what do we do at the end of the day, looking back on the day and seeing how we kind of tied up together, how we went, and how to actually judge if we've had a good day or not. And then for next week, we're going to look at how to put everything together in a practice around the six perfections. So many people know about, have heard about the Noble Eightfold Path, which is more in the Pali tradition, and the six perfections is in the Sanskrit tradition. So that's kind of the trajectory for the next couple of weeks. But in particular, what we haven't talked about is how to find a spiritual guide or a guru or a lama. And this is a really crucial question to ask, because if we look at who we already have as a spiritual guide or a lama, pretty much our default in the secular world is influencers. That's who our gurus are. And just like people get into trouble with influencers and believe what influencers say, you know, take their medical advice from an 18-year-old influencer because, you know, they've got 6 million followers, so they must be right. So very similar things can happen with finding a virtuous friend or a spiritual friend. But the results can be even more catastrophic than just this life, because it kind of has ramifications for this life and all future lives. Many people ask me, you know, how do you find a guru? And there are many different types of gurus and many different ways that we can relate to spiritual teachers. But I really wanted to start with something very practical. So when we, I mean, one thing is, how do we even know if we choose a teacher or not? Are we lucky enough to be able to choose to have a smorgasbord of perfectly qualified Mahayana virtuous friends and go, oh, I think I want that one, you know, like a tray of bonbons? It's not quite like that. You know, we just kind of, well, at least I know with me, you barrel through life kind of blind and drunk and, you know, whatever, and then just come across these extraordinary holy beings. And here in Australia, in particular, even in Southeast Queensland, we do have a wealth of perfectly qualified Mahayana gurus, and we have access to them. And in a way, we've been spoiled, because I just thought, oh, well, that's how they all are. But it's not true. It's just like in the rest of the world, there are various degrees of qualifications. So I was thinking, one way that we can think about it is, for instance, if you're a dancer, if you're learning ballet, or you're learning piano, or you're learning to drive, there are a huge range of people that can teach you, but you want to find the best, isn't it? And when you hear about great dancers, one of the first things that they say is, oh, I studied under so-and-so, you know, and they trace back their lineage all the way back to, you know, I studied under Martha Graham or Balanchine or da-da-da, all the way back. And it's a very precious thing, because it's a living tradition. Also with great musicians as well, who their teachers are. And even though they may be world famous, incredible, great musicians, they still have a teacher. And that teacher still has a teacher as well. They never stop learning. So in the secular world, when we find a dance teacher or a piano teacher or a driving instructor, they may be good at what they do. The rest of their life may be a mess. You may have a driving instructor that's going through a massive divorce and shouts at his kids or whatever, but good at driving. So, you know, okay, I'm going to take advice of how to drive from this person, but I'm not going to take marriage advice from this person. And we also expect a degree of professional conduct, don't we? So even if the driving instructor's life is a mess, we expect them to treat us with respect and, you know, not fiddle the books with money and not bring in all of that personal stuff into our learning to drive relationship. So there is an expectation of professional conduct, and that's just in the secular world. When we go to a doctor, we expect professional conduct from that doctor. So the very minimum, when we embark on a spiritual journey and we take someone as our teacher, we've got to be very practical and have an inner skeptic right at the beginning and be very hard-headed about it. Because once you embark on a spiritual journey and you throw your lot in with a teacher, then it's really important to have devotion and not to question them. So the questioning comes beforehand. Really important. The other thing that happens is it is important that we fulfill from our side what a student is supposed to do, the responsibilities of a student. And part of that means that that we're not naive about it, that we don't just become really infantile and just put our whole life into the hands of the guru, like, what job should I get? Where should I send my kids to school? What diet should I have, as well as what spiritual journey I'm on? You know, we don't abdicate all responsibility. It's a two-way relationship. And so just like if we're learning how to dance or play the piano or drive, we have to practice. And it's no good getting a teacher and going, oh, well, they're no good because I still can't drive, but I haven't actually ever got into my car and practiced. So when I was learning to drive, like I learned to drive quite late in life. I actually regret not learning to drive when I was young and stupid and brave. I learned to drive when I was old and terrified and I didn't have a car. So my practice was at the driving lesson. So I got to drive once a week for a year. It took me a year, and that was the only time I ever drove. I don't know what my driving instructor thought of me. He knew I was tabula rasa, blank slate. So we've got to probably do a little bit more than that if we want to progress along the path and actually practice ourselves and put it into practice and try things out. And then when we've done some practice, then go back to the teacher and go, okay, now what? What's next? But many times we kind of have this quite passive approach, just like we're watching TV or watching YouTube and just going, oh, yeah, just tell me what to do and make it better. I mean, I know, you know, when problems happen, difficulties happen, and you just go, yeah, that's too complicated. I just want an easy answer. You know, we all want an easy answer, but actually we've got to put the practice in, and then things will eventually become easy. So, you know, that's my kind of preamble. There is a checklist of qualities when we're looking for a spiritual teacher. And so this is particularly to do with the qualities of a spiritual guide in the Mahayana Sutra teachings. But I think it's a very good checklist for anything, for any kind of teacher. Of how to tell if the qualities that are necessary are there and which ones we don't have to worry about. It is very rare to find a perfectly qualified Mahayana guru, spiritual friend. It's like a star in the daytime. It's very, very rare. So let's have a look at the qualities of a spiritual guide. So they're divided into these, there are 10 qualities, the 10-point checklist, and they're divided into conduct, wisdom, and how to look after students. So this also we can take on board for how we relate to others, which you'll see in a moment. So the conduct is basically to do with the three higher trainings. And next year I'll be leading a course called The Three Higher Trainings for Dummies. And I think I led that just earlier this year as well. So the three higher trainings is the way to become a really good human being. It's the minimum of what we need to become, just for ourselves, a good human being. But the three higher trainings also is how a teacher should conduct themselves with others. Ethical discipline is number one. So there's no room for a double standard. So we can't learn how to tame our mind if our teacher has not tamed their mind and has tamed ethical conduct. So our teacher has to abide by the law. It's that simple. Whatever the laws of the land are, they have to abide by the law. It's not like, oh, you're a guru, so you don't have to, or you're famous, so you don't have to. I know how cross I get when I hear about this, the, you know, a different rule of law for rich people than for the poor. So the ethical discipline that they've tamed their mind and then therefore tamed their behavior, and there's got to be evidence of that. And so a double standard is kind of where people might go, oh yeah, but that's different because, you know, I'm special, or I've got a special dispensation, or, you know, the teacher can be late but nobody else can, all of those kind of things. Anytime you see a double standard, your little warning lights should go on. So if we have a dance teacher or a piano teacher, they may be brilliant at music, at dance, but they may not have ethical discipline. And there are many Hollywood movies about such a thing where the maestro, the great dancer, you know, the choreographer sleeps with all the first ladies. What are they called? Prima ballerinas. And there's a lot of abuse that happens that way because of the discrepancy in power. And that is just not on. And that's why ethical discipline is number one. There's no double standard. So if you see a double standard, don't discount it. Call it for what it is. And even in our culture, you know, it permeates everything, doesn't it? And we have a tendency to kind of become an apologist for the things or the people we like, but we really got to call it out. So ethical discipline, meditative concentration, that our mind is, that their mind is pacified, having pacified disturbing emotions. So it's only when you've pacified attachment, pacified lust, pacified aversion, pacified resentment that you can actually concentrate. So that one kind of is the result of having dealt with the disturbing emotions within. And then training in wisdom. And so that's called thoroughly pacified. And that means having an understanding how everything holds together, the big picture. Like we've been talking in the previous classes about dependent arising and the no inherent existence. So having a training in that and developing that. So that's the three higher trainings for the conduct of a spiritual guide. So even you might hear about great, crazy, eccentric yogis like Milarepa, who lived in the mountains and just, you know, wrote poetry and didn't even have any clothes, but he still had ethical discipline. So even though from an outside world he was eccentric and the villagers threw stones at him, he was incredibly kind. He never killed any animals. He didn't disturb the environment. He lived completely ethically. So there is a difference between an eccentric or someone that's just a charlatan, you know. So are there any questions about this so far? Anything at all? Yeah, Christine?
Yeah, it's probably like Bikram yoga. When that fellow who did the Bikram yoga, do you know that? And there was all those stories that came out later on, like everyone, like all the Hollywood celebrities and, you know, just used to follow him, and then all that stuff that,
yes,
he was doing some dodgy things. But for a long time, yeah, everyone believed in his practices or him and everything. And they still do Bikram yoga, but it's really tainted.
That's right. It does really get tainted. So this is the thing that we've got to be careful not to be extremists. So when you find out that the guru has been, you know, not practicing ethics, has been, you know, taking advantage of the money, sleeping with all the girls, all of those things, it does taint their practice. So how... I mean, it's kind of ironic that then the people that actually practice, they're the ones that are humble, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama that says, I'm just a simple monk. So they don't have the big rah, rah, rah charisma, and they don't big note themselves, and they treat everyone equally, so that you kind of might accidentally think they're ordinary. Whereas the ones that go around all big noting themselves and everything, they kind of open themselves up for corruption. And it is a rare person that isn't corrupted by all that power, all those accolades. Yeah. You know, like all of the teachings that His Holiness has given around the world when, you know, they people sell tickets so that they can cover the cost of the venues and everything, then it's complete transparency with the money, how much was left over, they offer to His Holiness, and then His Holiness offers it to all these different places and says, this much to this place, this much to this charity, da, da, da. It's all completely transparent because of that, because it's so important to not taint the practice.
Yeah.
So it's a tricky one. And it depends how much we've been harmed, I suppose. But when you think about, say, a driving instructor, if your driving instructor ends up molesting you, you would have nothing to do with your driving instructor. But would you stop driving? Would you go, I'm going to burn all the cars and I'm never going to drive again?
I suppose that's it, isn't it? It can stop you from following your practice or your beliefs, or you could just think everybody is in that field.
Yeah. So you can see how it can really taint everything and why it's so crucial to check out the person first. But nevertheless, if you learn to drive, you might just become a very, very good driver and you still drive, but you just have nothing to do with that instructor ever again. And in fact, warn everybody about them. So you can see there's a huge responsibility, a professional responsibility for the teacher to make sure that they don't ever taint what they're teaching, because, you know, then it can actually taint something that's very, very useful for people. So it's hard for us to negotiate this middle way, not chuck the baby out with the bathwater. And why I think Westerners get into a lot of trouble is not checking out the guru first, but just jumping in because they've got charisma. It's pretty much the biggest mistake that we make as Westerners, and because we don't quite know what the checklist should be. So let's go on with the checklist. Then we've got the wisdom side of things. So they have to be well-versed in scripture, which means they've got to be able to quote their sources and say, this is who says. Just like if you're teaching science, you've got to be able to say, you know, Newton said this and Einstein said that and la, 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 and actually quote your sources. You can't just be some new age person that says all is one and one is all because I like the sound of it. So well-versed in scripture means that when you ask that person questions, they can quote their sources. So you can verify and you can go and do further study and research and see and check up. Most important. If you can't find a source for it, dodgy. You know, if the source is I've just been channeling something yesterday, then you want to go, well, who are you channeling from and how can I tell, kind of thing. So Daryl's question, does a person have to be ordained to be a guru? No, it doesn't necessarily. So there have been some very famous lay person, householder practitioners like Marpa, Milarepa's teacher, who wasn't ordained, wasn't a monk or a nun. But if a guru is ordained, is a monk or a nun or a geshe, then that's like number one, the ethical discipline. So then they can't be a double standard with that. They can't go, oh, I'm different. So some gurus, some monks and nuns do disrobe and become householders. And that is perfectly okay because you're still then sticking to the ethical discipline of a householder. So we'll get to that one, Daryl. That's number six. So let's go. So then number five, that they've conceptually realized emptiness. So that means having an understanding, at least intellectually, about ultimate truth, the nature of reality, and dependent arising, how things actually exist. So even if the teacher hasn't fully realized all the way up to directly realizing emptiness, they must conceptually understand it so that they can help us, so that you know, we don't get tangled up. So it's just like, say, with a really good psychiatrist or psychologist, that they really understand the method that they're using. So they may not have fully realized the method themselves. They may actually use the method on themselves, but they conceptually understand how it works, so that the advice that they give will be beneficial, will help. The third point with the wisdom part is that the guru or the teacher has to know more than the student. So in that particular topic, so if you are studying, if you're studying the wisdom teachings, they have to know more about that than you. If you're studying piano, they have to know more about the piano than you. They might know more about cooking. They might know how to buy a house. They might know, you know, what, how to choose what school to send your kids to. They just have to know more than you on the spiritual path. So this is an interesting thing, because many times people will have a, say, a Tibetan teacher who is a lama, you know, Geshe maybe, who's done all the study, 15, 20 years at the monastery. They're an ordained person. They're holding monk's vows. And then they come and they just ask relationship advice. So what is a celibate Geshe from Tibet going to know about relationship advice in the West? They might be able to tell you about the disturbing emotions motivating everything, but, you know, what to do, should I get married or not get married? They're not going to know what to say about that, and that's a crazy question to ask them. So to know more about the spiritual path, how to make those kind of decisions, that really the inner story, becoming an inner being, not the worldly stuff, should I invest in these shares or not? So then Daryl asks, so what about me? Am I a guru? No, I am not a guru, but I am a registered teacher in the FPMT. So I have done some study, and I do continuous off and on study, and I know more than the students in the class. So this is what's given me hope and courage to actually be able to lead a class, because sometimes by the end of the class, that's it. I've said everything that I know and I'm all out. I don't know one other thing. And now I've got 1 week to go away and read up a whole lot of things and put it all together so that I can be just like one step ahead of you guys. But as long as I am one step ahead of you guys, it's going to work. Ideally, what we want is, you know, someone that has deep realizations and a wealth of experience. So I've got a wealth of kind of mistakes that I can share with you, and a little bit of hard-won experience. So as long as I can, you know, be a couple of steps ahead, then it's going to work. But also what can make sure or give you confidence is that I've read enough, and I always try and say, this is my opinion, or this is the book that I've sourced this from, this is what this lama has said, or this is just what I've found in my own experience. So you can calibrate it, how you take on that information and do further checking. And that's really important. Then how to look after the students. And Geshe Tashi Sering, who taught here for many years, said these four is actually how anyone who volunteers at a Dharma center should approach it. We can all do this. This is a brilliant way of the skills that we need to be able to look after others. How to become an inner professional. So being skilled at teaching means that you can effectively lead students. And so there is a part in there where you try and have an engaging manner, or tell some jokes, or you understand the culture and the customs of where you're teaching. So I think of someone like Geshe Zopa, you know, who teaches on the Sunday afternoons, And he's so engaging and he's so accessible, you know, and he teaches in English and he uses all of the modern day examples, and he mentions Trump and COVID and all of these things, and really makes the teachings come alive. It really bridges that wisdom of the Buddha right to us right here. So that kind of skill in teaching, it is important, because unless we've done a lot of study, if we sit down to a formal way of how the Tibetans teach in the monasteries, it's very dry. So it is worth being skilled in teaching. And if you're a parent, this is also a skill, isn't it? How to help your children grow. You can't just tell them, you have to be skilled at it. Motivated by love, not motivated by money. So this is another one, that if you come across a spiritual path where only rich people can go, or you are desperate for help and you don't have enough money and they say no, that's a double standard right there. That's something that little warning bells should happen as well. So the motivation is the kindness and care for others. So the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, are free. There's no charge. They should be given freely. So where the charge, where the cost of things is for the building and the air conditioning and the insurance and all of that. But that's why, you know, we have all of our classes at Lunnery Tumba Centre by donation, because they must be. Otherwise, and actually I think in the Buddhist tradition, you're not supposed to charge money if you're a doctor, for instance, you know, to profiteer off the suffering of others. So that's the main motivation, regardless whether you're respected, given lots of accolades or not, regardless of whether you get this much money or that much money or no money, that's not the motivation. So sometimes when I go to other centres and I lead a class, I'll be offered a donation for doing that, for leading a course. And so sometimes it's an astounding amount of money, and other times it's hardly any amount of money. And so in my mind, it's like I try and keep myself honest, you know, to have the same response regardless. So I have been able to do that, which is really good. Then being content with one's work. So being enthusiastic about teaching and not bored and not thinking, oh, that subject's for babies. You know, I'm sick of that. I want to teach something more advanced and more exciting. So the thing is that, or something more important with more status to it. The thing is, whatever the students need, then you offer that. So it's not about me and advancing my career. It's about whatever students need, you offer that. And I think of Geshe Tashi Sering, and an incredible Geshe, a Larumpa Geshe, you know, top of the class, top of 2,000 people, and highly respected by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And he still teaches Lam Rim every week. Lam Rim, the graduated path to enlightenment, right for the very, very basic. And he does it with such enthusiasm and such care, really demonstrates that. And then the last one of being patient and tolerant. So that means that regardless of, you know, to not have teachers' favourites, for instance. So to not just want the easy people, and, oh, that person's a bit difficult, so I'm just going to run away from them or ignore them. It's everybody. You've got to help everybody. So having that's kind of like that inner professionalism, like we'd expect with a teacher. Even a kindergarten teacher would expect them to have the same amount of care for all the little kiddies, regardless of how eccentric those little kiddies are or how different. And some might be loving and meek and wonderful and you like them, and others may be a real challenge. But we expect our teachers to have professional care for all of them equally. So same with our looking after students. Okie dokie. So let's see, being well-versed in scripture. So does it mean the original text? It might. So if you're a Geshe, you do. You memorize the text, but you have them in the Tibetan, not in the original Sanskrit or Pali. But then again, someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he's taken teachings from many traditions. He studied the Pali tradition as well as the Sanskrit tradition, but his main thing is the Sanskrit tradition. So at least to be able to say, this is the lineage, this is the tradition that I'm quoting from, these are the great masters that I'm quoting from. Different translations do have different interpretations, and that's the other thing, that a guru, a spiritual teacher, they take these texts, these spiritual texts and the words of the Buddha and all the commentaries, and it's a living tradition. They offer their experience. I mean, and that's why we need a teacher. We can't just get it from a book, because it's the strength of the experience that is communicated. And what you have, you know, there's universal reality, there's relative truth, how we live through our life, but what we have is a living being who's helping us interpret that and guiding us through and sharing all of their wisdom and knowledge. And that's what makes the effect on us. So we've got to be able to trace it back to the source, but why we don't just have the book is kind of like why we don't just learn to drive from a book. Then I have a little bit then about choosing a guru. So this is our checklist. And as you can see, it's a checklist. It's a great checklist for anyone that you are going to take teachings from, whether it is just in cooking, learning to drive, learning ballet, or on the spiritual path. But most importantly, on the spiritual path, to have a look at this checklist. And the thing to watch out for is that many times we just go for, are they skilled in teaching? Do they have charisma? Oh, yeah, they're so great to listen to. And we forget about checking the rest. You know, what's happening behind closed doors? Very intelligent people get caught out all the time. So how do we choose a guru? This is my opinion. So first off, the first one, I'd call it judge your own crazy first. So when we are choosing a guru, to actually get the most out of it, we've got to look at our own responsibility as a student first. Like, we have to make a commitment, because we might have the best teacher in the world, but you know, to learn piano, but if we don't actually practice piano every day, we're not going to develop, and we can't just blame the piano teacher. So this is something that doesn't really happen in the West. We don't really look at ourselves and go, am I a worthy student? We just, you know, want a spiritual teacher, and we're so yearning for spiritual guidance that we'll just fall for anyone that has charisma. So to recognize, yeah, we've got our own crazy, we've got our own kind of infantile yearning and longing, and to become aware of that, just to see it, what it is, how bereft we are of an inner life and how much we yearn for meaning and purpose in life, and become aware of that. And then, what are my responsibilities? And the responsibilities are, of a student, is to think, am I going to put it into practice? Am I also trying to live ethically? Am I willing to put in effort? And then we use common sense, and then we check out the qualities of the guru, of the lama. And use that 10-point checklist. So it's really important to do that, to do all the checking before you commit, before you pay the money. And many times, like I've noticed, you know, people will go to teachings And I might have a couple of friends on one side and a couple on the other. And what they'll say about the teaching afterwards is completely different. People hear completely different things. And some people will get a huge amount out of it and just be beside themselves with happiness. And others will go, oh, that made no sense at all. They're stupid. And I'm like, we're all at the same teaching. How can this be? So it's because we bring a different approach, each one of us, to the teachings. And a spiritual path is different. We're so used to just consuming stuff instantly off Google, watching TV, being quite passive, having everything handed to us, that it's quite a shock to realize we have to do active listening. We have to engage in an inner conversation. We've got to have a commitment from our side and put in some work. So that's why those kind of examples I'm using of an actual skill like piano or cooking or dancing or driving, where it's clear that we need to have our side as well. Then the second one, when we have chosen a guru, then we put our life in their hands. But how we do that is nuanced and it depends on the context. And so in the Mahayana Sutra tradition, what we do is we see the Lama as being like the Buddha. They're like a representative of the Buddha. Like His Holiness the Dalai Lama is like the Buddha. He's like, the Buddha's representative on earth and kind of the bridge between us and the Buddha. Then in Tantra, once we actually enter a tantric path and take an initiation, the whole context changes. Everything changes because Tantra is the lightning vehicle. Everything happens very fast and very intensely. And for everything to work, you can't have doubts. So then to get the most out of that approach, you see the Lama as being the Buddha, as actually being a Buddha. So you'd see someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama, not as an ordinary human, but as Chenrezig Compassion Buddha. And by having that very strong devotion, then you can progress very quickly. So why I put a picture here of a soldier is because we are here at war with our disturbing emotions. You know, the real enemy isn't the enemy out there. The real enemy is our disturbing emotions and our confusion and all of our prejudices and judgments and how we get so overwhelmed and how some of them are really sneaky. So here we are. We put our life in the hands of the whatever you call the boss of the unit, you know, the general. We put our life in their hands. And when we're in the thick of battle, that's not when we go, no, I'm not so sure about this general. I don't know if I'm going to do what he says. We just do how we're trained, exactly what he says, without question. And that way everything works well. So in the heat of battle like that, you have to have that degree of devotion. And the only way that degree of devotion is going to be safe is if you check them out first. The other example I like to use with this is, say, with boxing. When you're a boxer, you have a coach and you do what the coach says. And when you're in the middle of that boxing match and you're punch drunk and the coach says, you know, they either know to say, go for it now, and you must drop all your strength because your coach believes in you and you do, or the coach calls it and says, no, finished. You can't go on. And you might be going, no, I can do it, because you're punch drunk. And they go, no, it's not safe. You have to stop. And they call the match off. So that only works if you have 100% devotion to your coach beyond your instincts. And that's why it's so important to have checked the coach out beforehand. And we are in a life and death battle with our disturbing emotions, aren't we? And in the heat of battle, when everything we want to do is just retaliate and just, you know, shout at everybody, and our guru says to us, no, practice patience. Don't retaliate. and everything in us wants to. We've got to have enough devotion to go, this is what they said, I'm going to do it. Oh, so it's pretty big, isn't it? And then the final point, that who we choose as a guru, don't just base it on charisma or how many disciples they have, or if they're very flashy, or if they're well presented and have a really funny way of teaching, you know, all of that kind of thing. We've got to look beyond the presentation, the spin, to see, are they delivering the goods? Have they tamed their mind? Do they have at least a conceptual understanding of the nature of reality? Do they have scriptural learning? Can they effectively guide us? And so I put a picture here of a surgeon, because we don't choose a surgeon on whether we like the same, we have the same taste in music. We wouldn't, you know, we don't necessarily choose a surgeon about what their taste of clothes is or whether they've got a great sense of humour. Like, that's not what we're looking for in a surgeon. What we're looking for in a surgeon is a very specific skill, and we want them to be highly skilled at it. And they may have a very blank bedside manner. They may not sugarcoat anything for us. And we might be looking for someone to go la, 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 and make it all soft and fluffy. That's the job of the nurses, the social workers. But a surgeon, we want them to do what they can do, which is go right in there and save our life. So once we've checked the surgeon out and we've decided on a surgeon, then we have to actually do what the surgeon says, isn't it? We can't go off and do all that exercises and break all of our stitches and say it was their fault. So once we actually, on a tantric path, once we take a guru, then because we've done all the checking, then if there's any fault, we even incorporate that into the practice, that they're teaching us. They're still teaching us. They're still our guru. So any mistake that our guru makes then on that higher level of the path, we don't blame them. We see it as a manifestation of our own negative karmic vision. So they even say, for instance, with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who is getting quite elderly now, the fact that His Holiness the Dalai Lama looks old to us is an effect of our own negative karmic vision. It's just cause and effect, but it's our cause and effect. And as I've, you know, said many times before, when we actually look at His Holiness, who we've got to remember, you know, as a Buddhist, we don't just see a person. We see beyond the person, beyond an elderly man, beyond a Renaissance man, beyond a man the product of his times, to the embodiment of Chenrezig Compassion Buddha. So then, what questions do we have? Oh, yeah, Christine?
Is it okay to ask a person who their guru is?
Yes, actually, it's very good to do that, to ask. And what I've found, and this is just my opinion too, that really, really good teachers will say, oh, my master, I studied, like Geshe Zopa, he'll talk about his master. He won't say my guru, like his possession. He'll say my master. And his master, Geshe Lama Khonchog, who was like a living saint, just an extraordinary human being. And there were rainbows in the sky when he died, you know, just was just amazing. So the way he says that, his master, you can tell he has perfect guru devotion. Whereas if you come across some of the translators of the texts, they'll say, oh, you know, I've taken teachings from His Holiness and from Sakya Trizin and from Trailag Rinpoche and Lama Zo Rinpoche, and they've got like this huge list of people they've taken teachings from, and it's like a status thing. But they haven't said, this is my master. So that's just how, like, I've just noticed this is a trait, and this is how you can kind of check it out. So it's important. It's important to tell so that you can also trace the lineage back and see that there is a valid lineage there. Yeah. Yeah, Daryl.
Do you have to ask someone to be your guru? So, you know, do you have to approach a teacher and say, can I be your student?
It depends on the context. So when you take refuge, for instance, it's a living tradition all the way unbroken from the time of the Buddha till now. And then that whoever you take refuge from becomes your refuge master. So they become a form of a guru. Then you may have someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama when he gave Chenrezig Compassion Buddha initiation, and there are hundreds and hundreds of people. But in the ceremony, you ask, you request, you make a mandala offering and you request them to give the initiation. So they become your guru. Yeah. But you may never actually speak to them. But that's okay because we get to see His Holiness on telly and on a DVD whenever we want. And in our dreams, we can even have a direct teaching that way. So it's quite malleable. It's not the same as, just say a teacher at school that we see every day. We might have, it's like the maestro, you know, we only see the maestro every now and again, but we have our tutor that we see much more regularly. And then we have our Dharma buddies, brothers and sisters that are also the helpers. So there's a context. Oh, okay. So then I just got a little word of warning. This is from Reginald Ray, Secret of the Vajra World. And I'm going to read it because I'm just a bit struck by how much influence influencers have. And here's a way to put it into perspective. So he says, people are often impressed by a teacher's learning or eloquence. If a teacher seems to know a great deal and can speak in an interesting and entertaining manner, they may think that this is a worthy guide. In the modern world, if a teacher has written popular books, has achieved fame, or has a large following, people may be impressed and willing to follow him or her. However, according to Chögyal Trungpa, he says, eloquence is not the most important quality of a Dharma teacher, for it's not so difficult to deliver a nice lecture. What's crucial is that through a genuine and profound practice of meditation, he or she maintains a direct personal experience of the teachings. Otherwise, the teacher might be like a parrot who repeats again and again, practice virtue, don't practice non-virtue, but who devours an insect as soon as it enters the cage. In attempting to find a qualified mentor, one can and should ascertain from others his or her qualities. So ask others, you know, check out how are the rest of the disciples, you know, what's their effect in the world. Most important, however, one should rely on one's own observations. Does the teacher show kindness and compassion in his or her actions? Is that teacher beyond self-interest and devoted to the welfare of others? Does he or she exhibit wisdom and accuracy in dealing with situations? Has that teacher integrated the teachings into his or her life? And does he or she truly live them? When near the teacher, does one feel his or her mental stability, openness of mind, and realization? So it's nice, isn't it? You know, so I think you can really, if you have this approach, a careful approach, then you can trust your own instincts and you won't get sucked in to a charismatic cult. You won't be betrayed. And when you notice that there might be some human flaws about your guru, you won't lose your guru devotion because you won't lose the big picture. So, you know, I remember Lama Zorup Rinpoche when he was teaching in Bendigo, it's just one of the best times of my entire life. I'm so fortunate to have been, you know, 6 weeks every single day taking teachings. And I mean, one of the teachings when we're getting ready for a long life puja and everyone kind of dresses up and it's a big special occasion. And for some reason, Rinpoche mentioned something about didn't like makeup on women. And he said, because it kind of looks a bit unnatural. So I just thought that was hysterical. And I really wanted to say, what about, you know, green Tara, who's green and has how many arms? Don't you think that's a bit unnatural? So, you know, in my mind, I kind of said that, but I didn't lose my guru devotion because you can see there's all these layers. It's a cultural kind of thing. It's just something you're saying to stir people. It also made me think about, why do I wear makeup? Is it because I don't want to appear ugly to my students and they have something nice to look at? Or is it just vanity, you know? So all of this stuff, when you have guru devotion, everything that comes up, pleasant or unpleasant, you use on the path. And you don't lose, you don't lose your guru devotion. And you know, there's no one better guru than Lama Zopa Rinpoche. He really is a qualified Mahayana guru. But doesn't necessarily mean that it's an easy relationship. It's a living relationship. All right. So then the next little bit. Last questions. Yep, Christine.
Just with you, did it take you a while to pick your guru, or was that something that just came quite easily because of your knowledge?
So because I grew up with Buddhism. Yeah. So I grew up with Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and Lama Yeshe was like my heart guru. He was like my mother and my father. How I hear people talk about their mum is how I felt about Lama Yeshe. You know, 100%. And then, you know, my parents maybe like, 30%, something like that. So I was incredibly fortunate to meet the Lamas when I was a kiddie, and I didn't have stage fright or all of that kind of discombobulation that you can get as an adult. Yep. But then I hardly ever saw Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Once I started traveling around the world, maybe I'd be lucky to spend, you know, an hour with Rinpoche every 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that there isn't still a very, like, from, you know, I feel very strong connection, and I feel like he will always look after me in this life and all future lives. It's just up to me whether I kind of notice he's there. Mm-hmm. But then, like with Geshe Toshi Tsering, who taught here for 18 years, you know, his approach was to very strongly present himself as just a simple monk, a little bit like His Holiness says. And he would not take any of the kudos. He just wouldn't let anyone have that rah-rah kind of thing. But he is an amazing practitioner. And every now and again, he'll let slip. You know, he'll stop putting this persona of an ordinary simple monk, and you'll see the power that he has and what an incredible practitioner he is. And he is clairvoyant. And so, you know, one time when he came to, as a special occasion, take me and Eddie out for lunch, we're at the other building before this centre in Newmarket, a little house in Newmarket. And Geshe-la just said to us, are you sure you both want to come? You know, if one of you wants to stay home, you can. You know, otherwise, careful and lock up and let's go out to lunch. And we went, yeah, sure, we'll come. Even though actually one of us did want to stay back. Anyway, while we were away at lunch, the house was robbed. So Geshe-la just, he kind of knew something's going to happen. Are you sure? And be careful. And I wasn't listening. We weren't, neither me or Eddie, we weren't listening. We just thought, oh, Geshe-la's just like saying that to be nice. So there's been a couple of things like that where he's very pointedly said, but he hasn't done it in a rah-rah way. And from my side as a student, I wasn't listening. So after like the second time that happened, now I listen. But he, nevertheless, to have that kind of guru devotion took a lot of work from my side, because if there's no charisma coming back and there's no big, you know, production number or very slick, this kind of thing. For you to actually see what's there takes effort. And that is something we are not used to doing in our world. And same with His Holiness, you know, if you've been in the presence of His Holiness, just like when He's getting in a car and walking past, it's extraordinary. It's like the whole air turns to like liquid nectar. It's just amazing. And you're completely overcome. So the appearances. Okay, so just in the last little bit then that I wanted to share with you was how to do the speech blessing, because like I said before, we ourselves in a way are a guru for our friends, our children, anyone that we're responsible for. We have an effect on them. And often we may be the only person on a spiritual path in our friendship group, and when something terrible happens, someone gets divorced or loses their house or someone unexpectedly dies, it's us that they look towards as a friend. So how are we going to be ready? So one of them is to really have that 10-point checklist, and especially the last four of how to look after others, those who rely on us. And the other is to bless our speech. So speech blessing, don't leave home without it, because most of our interaction with the world, it's through talking, it's through speech. We don't, and especially now, we don't go up and hug everybody all the time. How do we communicate? It's through words. So we've got to make sure that our words are beneficial, that they have power, and that if we do a typo, we're not misunderstood, that the intent is understood. So this speech blessing, especially if you've got an important thing that you're doing where you're using words, like a court case or family discussions, make an important decision, or if you're going on a trip overseas, especially if it's not the same language, you know, and you're going to have language barriers, or what's coming up now, Christmas dinner, where we have everybody getting together and it becomes a minefield of difficulty. So how to bless our speech so that things turn out well. Also how to make our speech have power so people understand the meaning and pay attention to you. If we bless our speech, it also becomes meritorious speech. It means that when we speak, when we say prayers or mantras, we can bless our environment. And I really like this quote, instead of the song of samsara, gossip, 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 we can sing the mantra of dependent origination. So instead of just blah, 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 wasting all of those words, what we say can become a liberation. So the Ali Kali is kind of like the ABCs. It's the Tibetan way of saying the ABCs. And just like with the ABCs, we all learned how to sing it, didn't we? Either the American way or the Australian way. It's got a tune and it's a way of becoming familiar. Once we have those 26 letters, we hold infinity in our hands. We have an infinite amount of knowledge that we can get by just those 26 letters. It's like the DNA of wisdom, the DNA of communication. So blessing our speech like this with the Sanskrit syllables is like harnessing that DNA of the speech of the Buddhas. So what we might do is go through the speech blessing. So how you start, I've got a little image here, but I'd try and feel it from, you know, use your imagination. And what you do is that you kind of, first off, you think you're not just blessing your ordinary you, burdened with faults and limitations. What you're doing is you're blessing your potential. So think that on your tongue arises this syllable R, A-H. So you can imagine A-H, or you can imagine the syllable looking like this. And it's three-dimensional and standing upright on your tongue, and it's kind of a reddy pinkish colour. So this syllable R often is depicted on the tongue as there's a red syllable R at the throat, and it represents enlightened speech. So that potential, a seed syllable, that's like the seed of enlightened speech, is there with us right now. So we just bring that to mind. And then it dissolves into a sliver of a moon disc on your tongue, very fine and radiant and beautiful. So this moon disc, it's like the light of the moon. And it, what it is, it's your bodhicitta, your altruism become manifest. Radiant, calm, clear. And on it is an om syllable, a white om. So the om incorporates enlightened body, speech and mind. So you have the sliver of the moon on your tongue made of light and the radiant om syllable. And then out of this manifests what are called the three mantra garlands. So there's the mantra garland of the vowels, and they're white. Now in the picture here, they're flat, but try and imagine them standing upright. They're like little flickering, like little gas flames, but white ones. Then the middle mantra garland is red, and it is the consonants. And the mantra garland around the edge of the moon is the mantra of dependent arising. And it's blue. So I couldn't find any pictures to show them standing upright, but just to kind of give you an idea. So these three mantra garlands are there on that moon disc on your tongue. And then light beams radiate from those three mantra garlands into all of space, all 10 directions. And these light beams hook back the power of speech from the Buddhas, from the bodhisattvas, from beyond samsara, in the form of light that absorbs back into those mantra garlands in your tongue. So they start getting brighter and brighter and brighter. Hooks back all the power of speech from all the great orators, all the great yogis, all the great teachers throughout history in the form of light that absorbs into those mantra garlands. And at the same time, it hooks back all of the auspicious symbols. So I've just kind of depicted them here. You can see like all of space surrounding you, like a flotilla of these auspicious symbols, golden, made of light, so powerful insignia of all the good qualities, of all the perfect feng shui. So instead of like in Star Wars where you have all the, all the spaceships hovering there in space, like aggressively, you have all of these auspicious symbols just hovering there in space, filling the whole universe. And they're made of gold, and then they all absorb into your tongue as well in the form of light. So you're really absorbing a huge amount of power. Then we recite the mantras. So the first one is the vowels. And as you recite, white light flows from those vowels through your whole body. So your whole body becomes radiant with white light and nectar, and all of your negativities associated with physical actions and the body are completely purified in this life and all previous lifetimes. Om a a e e u u ri ri li li a a o o ung a swaha. So if you can do that, you can imagine the white light flowing through you, purifying all the negativities of the body from these mantra garland. We'll say it two more times. Om a a e e u u ri ri li li A A O O Ung A Swaha. Om a a e e u u ri ri li li a a o o ung a swaha. So physically, everything purified, your body radiant, filled with white light. Then the next mantra garland, the one in the central one, to do with speech. So this purifies all the negative speech that you've ever done. Yelling, lying, betraying people, gossiping, whatever negative thing in this life and all previous lives. And so as we recite this one, the red light flows through your whole body and it becomes incredibly radiant, and that red light purifies negative speech. So this is a bit trickier. We'll give it a go. Om kaka gaga na, zaza zaga na, tata dada na, tata dada na, papa baba ma, yara lava, shaka sahaka swaha. Om kaka gaga na, zaza zaga na, tata dada na, tata dada na, papa baba ma, yara lava, shaka sahaka swaha. Om kaka gaga na, zaza zaza na, tata dada na, tata dada na, papa baba ma, yara lava, shaka sahaka swaha. So feel how wonderful all the negativities of speech have been completely purified. And then the blue mantra around the very periphery of the moon disc on your tongue. And this is the mantra of dependent arising. And so this mantra, by the way, is also one that you can recite to bless any object, especially secondhand objects, objects that have a history to them. It completely blesses them. Om ye dharma hetu prabhava, hetun tekan tatagato, hayavada tekan zayo, niroda, evam vadi maha shramanaye swaha. So of course, as we're reciting this, then blue light flows from this mantra garland through your whole body. Your whole body becomes radiant with this deep bottle blue light, and it purifies the mind. All the negativities in the mind are purified. It becomes spacious and unobstructed, like deep space. Om ye dharma hetu prabhava, hetun tekan tatagato, hayavada tekan sayo, niroda, evam vadi maha shramanaye swaha. Om ye dharma hetu prabhava, hetun tekan tatagato, hayavada tekan sayo, niroda, evam vadi maha shramanaye swaha. So feel that all distorted attitudes and disturbing emotions completely purify, your body radiant, filled with the blue light. Then the blue mantra garland dissolves into light and absorbs into the red one, the one in the middle. That red mantra garland is almost like it kind of flames out. It gets very, very bright red and then dissolves into light and absorbs into the white mantra garland surrounding the Om. And that too gets brighter and brighter and brighter, melting into light, absorbing into the Om, which also dissolves into light, absorbing into the moon disc on your tongue. And just feel that sliver of light there on your tongue. So delicate, so rich, the manifestation of altruism, bodhicitta. And then that too dissolves into a pinkish syllable R. And that dissolves into light, pinkish light and nectar that absorb into your tongue, and your tongue becomes heavy with virtue. So feel that your tongue has the power of speech beyond samsara. Think that the power of your speech becomes perfect, that all whatever prayers and sutras you recite, the benefit is multiplied 10 million times. The power of your speech cannot be taken away by eating wrong foods. And even gossiping becomes the recitation of mantra. So this light dissolves into your tongue, and then the speech blessing dedication, now that our tongue is heavy with virtue, and as the light dissolves into your tongue, you can even think it's like, you know, when you have sherbet and your tongue gets all tingly, that it becomes tingly with virtue and light. And then the dedication prayer. May my tongue sense base have all the courage of the ones gone to bliss. By the magnificence and power of my words, may all sentient beings be subdued. May all the meanings of whatever words I say be accomplished. So I hope that gives you an idea of how to bless the speech. What I can do is email you out the booklet that has this speech blessing in it. So it's this really wonderful daily practice that Lama Zopa Rinpoche put together. And the first, it's just in a little kind of like A4 size thing. The first half are some Lam Rim prayers that it's like his, like a prescription for us of what to concentrate on every day so that our whole life goes well and continues being directed towards enlightenment. And then the second half of the booklet is the speech blessing. And really, don't leave home without it. So, I try and do the speech blessing every day. And sometimes I'm a bit slack, but I always manage to do it before class because, oh my gosh, you know, what if I do a typo or say something back to front in class or whatever? Like, I'm so worried that I'm going to lead you astray that everything that I can do. So I take refuge, I set my motivation, and I bless my speech, and I call on all the Buddhas to help me. But it really makes a huge difference. It's just extraordinary. And doing this practice, actually, when Rinpoche put this practice together, it was a few years ago now, and I'd had this terrible bout of flu. It must have been swine flu or something, and I lost my voice for a year. Like, I completely lost it for about 10 days. Like, no sound whatsoever came out. It was just broken. And then after about 10 days, I was able to make a croaky noise. And then for a whole year, the sound files of all my teachings, I sound like this, like a very heavy smoker. It was terrible. And I just thought I'd broken my voice forever. I had no puff left. I couldn't sing one line. I could sing half a line and I'd run out of air and I'd have to breathe in again and sing the rest. Couldn't lead any pujas, nothing. So that was pretty devastating considering I'm the one that has to lead all the pujas and it's all about singing and lead classes. Anyway, so this speech blessing came out and I started doing this speech blessing and it healed my voice. So, you know, now I could talk underwater and even leading yungnes and prayers and 5-hour long pujas, it's no problem. But it's actually this practice, it's like it healed all the negativity associated with losing my voice. So it's quite profound. So did you like it? Were you able to do it?
It'll take some practice for sure.
Yeah, it does. So they are the Sanskrit syllables, and Sanskrit's a little bit like French, that there's lots of kind of tricky bits and invisible letters and letters you say and letters you don't and whatever. But also keep in mind that just like when we speak English, you can speak English with a thick Scottish brogue and it's sounds quite different, and on SBS they even subtitle it. You can speak English with an American accent, you can speak it with a Strine accent. So, you know, the words themselves are also a dependent arising, so we just do the best that we can, but don't worry too much if it's got an Australian accent. What we're doing is we're using the power of these syllables to bless our speech and connect us with the enlightened speech of the Buddhas. And we just kind of do it nicely, mosey along. That's okay. So you can actually end up doing it quite fast, you know. So sometimes I do it on the fly with my coffee. So I have my coffee, and by the time the coffee, the caffeine's hitting, is right where the syllables absorbing into your tongue and the caffeine starts flowing through my bloodstream, and it's like everything synchronizes. It's really good. So, you know, I might be like feeding the cat and watering the garden and going, oh, ma, ah, ee, ee, ooh, ooh, ree, ree, ee, 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 oh, 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 ah, so, ha. Oh, oh, ga, 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 na, ta, da, 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 na, ta, da, 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 na, ta, da, da, na, pa, 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 ma, yara, la, va, sha, sha, sa, ha, sa, swa, ha. Coffee, 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 cat, whatever, make the bed. And then I go a little bit slower with the mantra dependent rising. Om ye dharma hetu prabhava, hetin tekin tadagato, haya tadagato, pussycat, haya vada tekin sayo, niroda, eva vadi maha shramanaya swaha. And then I blow on the cat, and his ears go, woo. So, you know, you can fit it into your day however you do. What I try and do is really focus my concentration so I have the feeling of the light going through me, with actually saying the syllables. So you actually heal your voice and your speech and your communication. It gentles your communication. And then absorbs, or you know, all of that goodness absorbs into your tongue. And then you just sit with that for a moment and then go out and have your day. And it really makes a huge difference. So I'll email you the booklet. It's called How to Transform a Suffering Life into Happiness, Including Enlightenment. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche really likes a heading that says exactly what it means. So they're very long. So it's daily practice, how to transform a suffering life into happiness, including enlightenment. So we're just about out of time. Are there any other questions or comments about the speech blessing? It's all okay. We might give it a go next week then. So we didn't get to do looking back on your day. So we'll do that next week and kind of put it together as a practice. We could do a nice short go through of the speech blessing. So let's dedicate the merits. Especially as we've been talking about guru devotion and finding a perfectly qualified Mahayana virtuous friend. So we can dedicate that, just as we've talked about the qualities and the checklist and how important it is to have a spiritual teacher, may we always be guided by perfectly qualified Mahayana virtuous friends in this life and all future lives. And from our side as students, may we meet all of the prerequisites so that everything turns out well. You know, from the side of our gurus, the fact that you're here at Lungri Tongpa Center taking teachings means you already have a connection with Lama Zopa Rinpoche, with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So they've already found you. Now you just have to find them. So, you know, we pray that just like they look after us in this life and all future lives, we may always find them and put their teachings into advice and actually fulfill our potential as human beings and help everyone in the world, all the beings in the world, out of suffering and into happiness. And then we can do the really nice special dedication. Due to the merits of the three times collected by us and all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all sentient beings, may any sentient being who hears us, touches us, remembers us, thinks about us, talks about us, whether they're praising or criticizing, abuses us, treats us badly, or makes any connection with us whatsoever, simply by having made that connection, may they never ever be reborn in the lower realms. May those sentient beings immediately be liberated from all diseases, spirit harms, negative karmas and defilements, develop faith in refuge and karma, and quickly achieve enlightenment by actualizing the whole path, especially bodhicitta. So just by us talking to people, just by us existing in the world, may it have that benefit. And then the special kind of COVID pandemic dedications, may us just hearing that someone is sick immediately cause that person to completely recover and have the most meaningful life by practicing the Mahayana path. And by us just hearing that someone has died, cause that person to immediately be reborn in a pure land where they can get enlightened. Okay, so thank you so much for coming along, and I hope to see you all for the last class in a week's time, and I'll email you the little daily booklet. Take care, maybe see you again. Couple of the other classes. I've got the How to Do Christmas for Buddhists tomorrow night. That's always a lot of fun. So, because I love Christmas. So, even though I was brought up a Buddhist. So there you go. You can figure out, you can find out all about that tomorrow night. So thank you, everybody. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Miffy.
Thanks, Miffy.
See ya.